Check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Barry Moore. My next guest is an old friend, a man of many hats. He's been a photographer, a DJ, a commissioner, a hotel concierge, and he's currently the host of Alberta Foodie. Coming up next, this is Aidan O'Yuckmas.
You know, I long time ago when the internet and the web stuff was happening, I registered a bunch of names, and one of them was BAM Podcast.
Oh, wow.
You still have it? No, I got rid of it because I did nothing with it for 10 years.
Oh, buddy, it's probably worth money now.
It probably is. I don't even know if anybody, like maybe somebody picked it up, maybe didn't, but it was BAMPodcast.com.
That's crazy.
Is that crazy that I owned that? I never did anything with it. Well, because podcasting, when it was first came out, right? Because podcasts were before the video thing, right? Yeah. And it was kind of like, okay, we can do the audio stuff, but video wasn't really there and podcasts were kind of there and whatever. And then podcasts kind of fell off and the video thing came in and now we're back again. Kind of, I don't know if it was.
I feel like subscription. People becoming used to subscription audio has made a space for podcasts that didn't exist in the beginning. Like I used to have a web show on Winamp, which is like it was an MSN Messenger plugin that, and you could just route your music through. So it was like a radio show.
Okay.
I had 1,100 listeners all the way around the world.
Really?
Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
It got to be more, but then I ended up just making playlists of music and then that was it. That's
just
all I did.
Just played it. Yeah. And then that way, basically everybody just listened to it or they didn't or whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
And then I had like 400 listeners because whatever. People like content. They like it fresh. And
well, Joe Rogan is a prime example that, you know, that's, you know, one guy that, you know, created something. And then there's a bunch of other people and depending on what kind of stuff you're interested in. Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because when you look at, depending on what you're listening to, like Joe Rogan is one of those guys that's so diverse in what he has, you know, one minute he's got some crazy lunatic guy on there and then he's got some, you know, guy, Elon Musk smoking up with him. Yeah. it's just like, wow, where'd that come from?
People ask me what I'd want for my podcast and for different reasons, I'd like to have a podcast like his.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care about, I mean, it'd be sweet if Spotify's like, hey, you $100.
Yeah, I like you.
I just like that it's not one thing. Like all the podcasts I listen to are like, whatever. They're essentially like single topic. Mm-hmm. Even the one I started here, single topic, like
most of your stuff is motocross right now. Is that
currently? Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why.
It's because you know, everybody in that group of people, right?
Yeah.
And that's what you know. And that's what you do. I mean, you could talk about plumbing, but it probably wouldn't be so much fun.
Nobody wants to hear about shit, but I like it. Like, we haven't even talked part, like everybody's bike comes up in the ice breaking part, you know, like, but like as a rule, I barely even talk in the podcast.
Let everybody else do their blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I kind of try to guide them and then whatever, like, get them to expand on things and then go from there. I use a lot of the techniques from Chris Voss. I don't know if you know who that guy is. Yeah.
Did you watch the masterclass? Is that why?
I watched his masterclass. I listened to his audiobook and he came up in my feed on YouTube.
On YouTube?
So, yeah. He basically, three different ways I heard the same story from him.
Like, you heard the same story from him?
Yeah, exactly. Fucking asshole. And none of you know what he just did.
I was able to get on the masterclass because Graham Toomey, he had it, right? And he let me get into his account and I went. And that was the first one I looked at. I was like, this is son of a bitch. He knows what he's doing. Yeah. But, you know, like that's what he did for a living, right? Yeah. So to be able to, and I thought, wow, you know, I wish I knew this when I was 20 so I could use that skill, you know, because that's such a skill to be able, and nobody even thinks of it, right?
Yeah. It's kinda, can I buy you a drink? No, you can't buy me a drink. I can't buy you a drink.
Yeah.
That's how a guy, a 20-year-old would use his skills to try and get laid.
Yep.
Exactly. Pretty much more important than money.
So true.
Yeah.
So true. These are just records behind you?
Yep. Right. Oh, and some books. But don't worry, I didn't read them. They're just there for decoration. Okay.
It's like my cookbooks. They're all there for show and tell. I open them like this and I go, wow, that looks a great recipe.
take the picture and like make your own version of it. And you're just like, oh, that's fucking it.
I bought years ago, I bought the American, 10th anniversary American test kitchen book. And it's a big, thick one. Yeah. And I just bought it and it gives you the best way of cooking everything, right? And different ways and whatever. And then, of course, I was like, oh, yeah, I got this with it. Marianne takes it out. She puts it open. And she goes through it. And she goes, she looks at the recipe and I'm like, what are you doing? She goes, I'm following the recipe. I'm like, oh no, I didn't buy that for following the recipes. But that's what she does. But she loves that book because she says the recipes are really good in there, but she follows it. And I'm like, I can't do that.
Yeah, no,
it just doesn't work for me.
I don't. Yeah. Paula, myself, we're not recipe people.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. Marianne likes, well, she, because I cook most of the time. It's not because she can't. It's just if she's going to make something new, she will look at a recipe and will want to try to follow it, right, and go with the thing. She's kind of one of those people, right?
Yeah.
The by the book kind of thing.
Yeah, that's pretty tough.
She'd be the first one that said me, call the police and say, oh, my husband actually did something. I know. She's a...
And for you, Marianne, we are... Like there is a plexiglass barrier between the two of us so. And he's got his mask on when he's not drinking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But that's crazy. So like, one of the things I want to talk to you about was your time on mountain bikes. So you were a mountain bike guide. You started your own company.
Yeah. So, it all started with getting into mountain biking after I did road cycling back in Montreal. So I road raced as a kid and, I discovered mountain bikes and I was probably around 16 years old, 16, 17 years old when mountain biking was just coming out. And so
yeah, I was going to say you're older than the mountain bike itself. Yeah.
Exactly. No, not that old, but almost, but that was just when mountain bikes were just starting to be produced, you know, like mass produced and stuff like that. And so I remember buying one, went out with a couple of people and then I started to race it. This was at the time where, you know, little organizations in different towns and places would have their own little thing, but it wasn't official. Like it was official just in that organization. And this was in Quebec. And so these guys started this thing. And so they would have races every weekend, you know, and most of the people that were racing in these were like all bike couriers. Like they were like all potheads and whatever else, but they could beat everybody. It was crazy. And so I got into that and I liked the atmosphere of it. It was really cool, chill, laid back. It was so different than road cycling, which is very structured and very like you had to do this and this and this.
Tour de France.
Yeah, very, very much so, you know, and so I said, oh, I really like this. And this is fun. It's kind of adventurous and whatever. So I got into it that way. And then I realized I wasn't much of a racer. I wasn't very competitive because I'd watch everybody pass me and go, oh, go man, you're doing great.
Cheerleaders.
You know? Yeah, I was the cheerleader. At the end of the race, we'd have beers, we'd have a good time, whatever else. So, but then what ended up happening was I ended up coming out west, specifically because I wanted to mountain bike and do more of it and decided I'll come out west. But first I went down to the States, to Colorado and to Utah before I made it to Banff. And went to Moab. So this is 1991. I was in Moab riding my mountain bike, which is a Gary Fisher Pro Caliber 1991. I had bought it from a buddy who was the guy that sold it. He was like the sales guy, but he had a demo for it. So I got it for a really good deal. And it was like the bike at the time. And it had no shocks. It had no clipless pedals. It had not, it was like straight up, you know. And I was riding. Moab was crazy. And I don't know if you know Moab. Moab's just got so much shit. Like, I mean, for motocross too, mm-hmm. It's like crazy. The place there was very well known. I mean, at one time, obviously the horseback riders and whatever, but then it became the Jeep Jamborees and stuff were being held in places like that. Cause they were so crazy in the way that you went up the hills and stuff like that. And then the motocrosses got into it. And then eventually the mountain bikers discovered it. So they started to go in all these places and I rode so many of the places there and I was like, this is great. And it came to Banff. And by then I decided to officiate races. So I started officiating. So I started officiating them. Then I finally, I did it provincially and then I did it nationally. And then at the same time, that was kind of, I was in that boat of trying to figure out what I wanted to do. Just got married, decided I wanted to get out of hotels. And that's when I started the mountain bike guiding company. And that was around 1995. So the first summer was actually 1996, but just prepping for that. And so, yeah, so I did the mountain bike guiding started. It was called Trail Masters Mountain Bike Guides. It was in Canmore, and I had my license for basically Kananaskis country in Canmore. Banff National Park did not allow it for mountain bike guiding, still doesn't. And I even went to Parks Canada and sat down. At that time, the superintendent was Charlie Zinkin. I even went and had a meeting with him one-on-one and said, hey, how can we do this? And he says, it's not going to happen. And I said, well, you got the horseback riding guys. Like, they're on horses. How come, we can't just ride whatever? And they said, well, that's part of a historical side of things, but mountain biking, no, we're not going to be able to do that. And I said, well, it'd be really good if you had guides actually leading people on bikes, because that's way more dangerous on a bike than it would be hiking. I said, so you have hiking guides and you give them, but you won't do it. Anyway, so it never happened. But I did talk to Kananaskis Country, and they were actually interested in what I was proposing, was to create a guide program. And they were pretty interested in it at that time. And they were like, hey, if you do come up with this, we definitely look at it and consider it. But anyways, yeah, I did that for a couple of summers and wasn't making any money. I was kind of, I call it the bleeding edge of a business. And it was at that time, Backroads and stuff, they were big. They were doing really well, but all of their stuff was on the road. And it was very specific to people that could, get on their bike. And if they were tired, the van would come and pick them up and, they'd go to their nice little camp or their hotel or whatever else and whatever. And mine wasn't like that. If you got on a mountain bike, you had the ride.
Yeah, sure.
You didn't have an out. Right?
No, so, no comfort.
No, yeah. Exactly. So
in the 90s in Canmore, I can remember when the mountain bikers were hated for trail building and all that kind of stuff. Like,
I think the biggest thing there, Barrymore, was that in the 90s, there was so many restrictions with, with the mountain bike. And it was the new sport, and the kids wanted to get into it and they wanted to do it. And they're really, so what they would do is they'd just go out into the woods and they'd create trails. And they were, they were basically trails that the kids created. And some of the trails that they did, and this was really interesting because where Silvertip wasn't built yet.
Yeah.
And I remember this real clearly. Silvertip Golf Course was built, and they were built on some of these trails that the kids had all been riding on. And then the golf course was there. So what did the kids do? They ripped on the golf course. And then eventually Silvertip came and approached us. At that time, I had started a bike club. It's called Georgetown Bike Club. This was the precursor to Rundle Mountain Cycling Club, actually. And me, Ross Bell Harry, and another guy, Bill Brandt, we kind of started all together. We called it the Georgetown Bike Club out of Georgetown, the old Georgetown town. And anyways, they came to us and they said, hey, would you, be interested in building the trail kind of around? And so what we did, we got a bunch of people and we just kind of built the trail. So you'll see what the trails that go around Silvertip and the golf course, we kind of helped build that diversion so that they wouldn't go on the golf course back in the day. And so that was the big part. And eventually the sport got bigger. We had, provincial races and then Canada Cup races and then World Cup that ended up happening. And then now, Canmore is just full of mountain bikers. Summer and winter.
They're building tracks and trails supporting it.
That's the thing about it is that it's an activity people can do. And it's, and now you can do it in the wintertime with fat bikes and whatever, not that I want to do it, but there's a lot of friends that do it and they enjoy it and stuff. And they're not really creating new trails. They just kind of ride the ones that are out there with their fat bikes. So it's no big deal that way. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
One of the things about the mountain bike community is the community part, the advocacy, the associations, all that kind of stuff.
Totally.
We don't have that at the same level in dirt biking, and seeing as dirt biking started before mountain bikes.
Well, I think the biggest thing with dirt biking and it's the hard part is because I think what it comes down to, it always comes down to this whole factor of as soon as they see motor, right?
Yeah.
You see a motor. Well, now we see with the electric bikes there, the mountain bikes, there's this whole thing of, should we allow electric mountain bikes on trails because they're electric? They're no longer but they are human powered, but they still have this motor and whatever
else. The assist and only thumb throttle, yeah. I guess, are allowed.
So it's kind of like one of those psychological things, right? So I think that's what it is. Plus, I mean, a guy on a mountain bike's, I mean, will create damage.
Yep.
Probably not as much as a horse will.
Nope.
And a motocross, well, you know, you start gunning it, it can do pretty, depending on where you're riding, right? I mean, it's conditions for sure. If you're riding in mud, whether you're in a mountain bike, a horse, or a motocross, it's all going to wreck the trail. So like, it's like, they're always, you know, with the Canmore Mountain Bike Association in Canmore, they're always like, oh, trails are wet really bad. Like, don't think about it. Don't, you don't need to go out. We got plenty of time to ride. And they'll tell everybody to motivate them not to ride in it. So, because then you just have ruts for the rest of the summer. Right. So
that's the same for dirt biking.
Yeah. Like, yeah, just use the common sense. Right. So
I just don't think that, because people don't realize, I guess mountain bikes are pretty like common, and dirt bikes are rare because they happen off like out of sight.
And it's interesting because I'm looking at the price of motocross, and they're cheaper than mountain bikes. Yeah, man. Sitting back and I'm looking at my daughter's, you know, transition patrol that she has is like $8,000-$9,000 or whatever else. And I'm like, that doesn't have a motor on it. I know.
That's more expensive than Paula's bike. She's looking to buy one. $6,000.
Like, really?
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
Brand new. That's all it is.
Look, that's all it is. I know.
That's what it's come
to. We're very wealthy here.
That's what it's come to. And that's the thing about mountain biking, is that it's just become, you know, it was originally kind of like the, you know, it was attainable and a basic form. And now even your least expensive bike is over $1,000 easy, mm-hmm. you know, and it probably will be okay on some trails, but probably won't be for, you know, the kids that are trying to throw themselves, huck themselves in a whatever in a bike park.
Yeah,
no, fall apart.
I guess the moral of the story is to get into dirt biking.
Yeah. Hey man, I'd be all for it. The only problem for me is that I think like some things, right, is one, getting, we live in a spot that kind of have to get out there, right? Yeah. You have to have the trailer, you have to get out.
That's and so on and so true forth. True for everybody, right? Yeah. Though.
Like, you guys in Eggshaw, do you guys have places where you can ride?
No.
No. Okay. No.
So go to Wipers.
Go to Wipers. Okay. Yeah. Got it. So that's the key factor is that, you know what, you go to McLean Creek.
Yep.
Down
that's
there.
A great one.
That's a good one. And that's how, an hour away,
yep.
An hour and a half.
And there they have the, like you said, the community, and their dirt bike club will definitely ask people to avoid certain sections and what have you.
That's perfect.
But the problem is it's a multi-use area.
Yeah.
So there's other vehicles. Now, we all like to blame the other guy.
Sure.
Right. So I'm riding through on my nature friendly dirt bike.
Yep.
And that jerk off on the ATV and the asshole in the Jeep, they're causing all the damage. Right. Like, you know,
yeah, for sure.
But like, I know that we share the blame.
Yeah.
I don't feel that dirt bike or mountain bikers own the damage they do at all. Mm-hmm. And, it's sort of terrible.
Yeah. Like, I think that's the thing. Cause so from around the mid-90s, I sat on the, Alberta Bicycle Association on the mountain bike committee. And so we were the committee that kind of dealt with all the mountain biking and the racing and all that stuff. And I had done some stuff with land access. And even at that time when I had the mountain bike guiding company, I actually went off and I did one of the, actually, I think the first, you know, trail maintenance day in Parks Canada. We actually went out and I want to say that it was by Lake Minnewanka or so on, but I actually managed to get Parks Canada to invite us and allow us as mountain bikers to go and do some trail maintenance.
That's awesome.
And so we went out there and we actually did something. And I, of course, at that time, you know, I was just trying to get the whole, you know, hey, we're nice people. We believe in the trails too. We want to take care of them. And so to bring a positive outlook to it more so than anything. And I have it. I mean, I still have the little clipping. I think it was 1996 from on the Canmore Leader in there, you know, picture and the whole thing, first trail day and so on and so forth. So it was pretty exciting. But you know, I mean, it was just to show that. And now we have so many people that, you know, they volunteer and do a whole bunch of trail work on the systems in Canmore and, you know, and so forth. So, I mean, I think it's gone to that next level, which is good.
Trail maintenance is a big part of all those sports.
Sure.
And when a lot of people, I guess, are intimidated by just the idea, like I'm sure the mental image that some people have having never done it, is that they're going to be clearing trees and pulling roots and making a trail for some people to ride down. And that's not what it is at all.
I think there's a lot of basic stuff. I mean, it's just fixing up the berms and making sure that the water flow, if there's a flowing water, and figuring out where it's going and draining out so it doesn't make the ruts, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But there's some real amazing, how can I call it, like techniques that have been developed in the past 20, 30 years in trail maintenance, and how to keep these trails so you don't have to do as much work on them, right? You know, putting pipes underneath and doing things and whatever, and packing them down and whatever else. But it's like anything, right? I think if you're right into whatever activity you're into, I mean, it just makes sense to put some time into it, right? And so
if you're going to do a day of trail maintenance, what could you expect?
You know, that's a good question. I haven't done it in a while, to be honest. I'm not going to lie to you.
You can fake it.
Yeah, I can fake it. I think it's pretty much going out there. You go out with a bunch of people, look at the section that, you know, the person, whoever the trail builder master would be, I guess, and supervisor, and kind of say, okay, we got to work on this spot here. There's a drainage spot here. We got to work on this, and let's build this up, or notice that the berm is coming down or something. And they go out there, and I think with their shovels and their picks, and, you know, kind of do the thing. I think that's what it pretty much is. Unless they're really developing, you know, diverting a trail because the trail is really bad and it's muddy, or creating a little wooden pathway, right, or over the muddy area because it's just swampland, and you can't ride it anyway. So then they build, you know, natural wood stuff, which the probably bridges. Yeah, bridges, and those over time they're not treated or anything most of the time. I think they're just, you know, regular wood. Some places might use treated, whatever. Exactly. I don't know. I mean, I haven't, like I said, I haven't done it in a long time, but Canmore Mountain Bike Alliance that does a lot of that stuff, so I should get more involved. But, you know,
yeah, it's all good, man.
Riding my bike.
Yeah, just ride your bike. Speaking of riding, you did a big ride on your bike, didn't you?
I did. I got back into what they call now gravel bike packing.
Gravel bike packing. Sounds like a homeless guy's motor.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going on my bike packing trip. but it was one of those things. I actually wanted to get back on the bike, and you basically load it up with your stuff. Different than touring in the sense that you don't have as much gear. You're kind of going out for a couple of days or whatever. So you try to pack super light. And so you really don't have a lot of gear on you, you know. And I originally was going to go on a mountain bike style bike that I was building for it, but the parts didn't get there in time. So I took the gravel bike, which is essentially like a road bike, except it's got more knobby tires and whatever else. So put fatter tires on it and whatever. And I went down to the Okanagan and did the Kettle Valley Railway. And the reason I did that was because when I knew it existed, I knew that I could do a shorter loop of it. And I was doing it solo just to kind of get away last August. And I knew it was away from people. So that was good. So there was no conflicts of any sort.
Social distancing.
Yeah, exactly. And the last time I had done something like that was actually back in 91 in Moab. We had taken our mountain bikes and we went out into the desert for two nights, you know, we just kind of rode our bikes out there and camped out and, you know, looked for water sources, had no clue. We were just, we were just like totally green. We just did it. We'd find these places. We were like, where's the next? And then we find a little hole thing and then put our chlorine tablets in it just to be able to drink something. It was horrible, but it was actually quite, it's a memory that's lasted. So I said, I want to do that again one day. And so it came up. So I went and did, I started down in, down in the south. There is, oh God, what's it called? Rock Creek.
Rock Creek. Okay.
Yeah. So I started in Rock Creek. If you go a little bit further south, there's actually mile zero, as they call it. And it's another little town, but I didn't start there. I got my buddies to just do, I drove my car and then they live in Penticton. So they just drove my car back. And so I started from Rock Creek and rode my bike for about 75 clicks on the gravel, dirt roads, whatever else, and a whole bunch of gates and things you got to open and close and do all this stuff because there's cattle and ranching and whatever. And then I got to this place called Arlington Lakes, which was just a beautiful spot, like just so calm, quiet, but the campsite was full. It was all car camping, trailers, whatever. And so they let the bikers basically camp out where the day use area is, because they know that those guys are light campers. They just got a little tent and whatever. And so I just had a one-man tent and sleeping bag, pulled out my stuff, pulled out my, you know, my little Stanley, my little burner, and did my little ramen, had that. And I slept there the night, got up really early in the morning and got on the bike. And then from there I headed towards Myra Canyon, which is a very popular area for biking. So if you go to Kelowna, a lot of people will go to Myra Canyon because they got the trestle bridges. So if you've you've been out there, they rebuilt those trestle bridges. Now the Kettle Valley Railway was a railway that went through that whole area and time till I think the late 50s or 60s, and when they shut her down, and it was the main source point where it would go through that whole valley and do pick up stuff like, you know, the fruits and vegetables from the Okanagan and whatever and so on and so forth. Right. So it's quite a historical thing, but then, you know, it was shut down and then they just kept the railway line as far as it goes. The railway itself is obviously those are gone, but the tunnels and everything else still exists. So it's a trail system. Now there's some of the trail system is kind of tough because there's those ATVs that are allowed on it and stuff, which is pretty tough because if you're riding a bike and there's ATVs coming around the corner, they're pretty fast, noisy, dirty, dusty, all that good stuff. And the other part is the running. There's a lot of sections there that were brutal, like to ride. And I don't know if I'd do some of those sections again, but I did end up at Shoot Lake Lodge, which again, beautiful place. It's just a lodge in the middle out there. It's not far actually from Kelowna and Naramata and stuff. Beautiful lake, great place. The lodge had great food and lots of local beers and all that good stuff, which was a savior after doing 75 clicks on a road that was, you know, when you say 75 kilometers, most cyclists that are in shape and whatever else would say, oh, 75, that's not a lot. But when you're on roads that are just gravel. Hard. No, it's not even gravel. I wish it was just gravel. Some of it's like quicksand and some of it's like big rutted spots where you're just trying to maneuver and try to keep the bikes upright without falling over. That's hard. And it's hard on the body because the gravel bike I have doesn't have any shocks, nothing. Right.
Yeah, no, it's a hard bike.
Yeah, it's a hard bike. It's hard tail. Yeah. And drop bars, right? Oh, so God. it's not even like, it looks like you're on a road bike, but you're riding on the gravel. So,
a 10 speed with mountain bike.
Exactly.
Tires.
Exactly. Totally. Anyways. So yeah, so we did that and got to Shoot Lake Lodge and then stayed there the night and found a spot in the provincial campground there, which was free because Shoot Lake Lodge, it was full anyways, and they didn't have any camp spots there. So it was like 5 minute ride to the provincial camp spot, found the spot there for free and just camped there, but had my breakfast and dinner and all that stuff. And then the next day, boom, it was down through Naramata. Again, road was kind of tough to ride through, but then it's just a downhill. It's literally, I didn't have to pedal. I just basically went and just, you know, got to a certain point. It was just like, hey, just let her go.
That's awesome.
So yeah. And that brings you down to Naramata, which is the wine country and all that area. And then Penticton is just right around the corner, of course. So, and that's where I ended. So it took me about 2.5 days to do it. And it's fun.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
The weather was good the whole time.
Beautiful weather. It didn't rain, sunny, and it was actually quite warm. It was actually probably 35 to almost 40 degrees.
So, oh, shit.
Yeah. But I was in the shade. The good part is a lot of the trail is in the shade. So you got a lot of tree coverage in a lot of places. So yeah.
35 to 40 degrees Celsius.
Yeah. Like, Celsius. Let's say that one. So it's
like whatever, like 100 degrees, 90 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Like crazy.
Yeah. One thing I did learn was how, you know, packing a bike and doing something like that, it just knowing the stuff that you need with you, you know, and kind of, if you're already a knowledgeable cyclist, just as if you're a motocross person, you're doing a long trip or something like that, you had one of those bikes, you know what things you need to have with you, right? You need to have certain tools.
Just in cases.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just in cases, you know, you want some lube or something and, you know, like, and that's one of the big things, I think, when you're doing something like that. I know where I was going wasn't like, you know, there eventually would be somebody and you'd run in. I mean, every so often I did see somebody, but it was quite rare, you know, and there was a points where you could get off the trail, like if you wanted to and get to civilization.
Escape routes.
Yeah, exactly. So which is very different than when you're somewhere out like in the desert area and stuff, like Moab.
Yeah. Or try. I guess if you're going to pedal your bike from, say, whatever, Ghost Lake to Sundry.
What's the old
Wipers on the 40?
Yeah, on the 40. Yeah. That wasn't that created for the wartime thing? That was it, the one that goes up all the way to Rocky and so on.
Oh, what's the 40 goes there. I don't know that was created for. Okay. I didn't know that.
I think it was actually the highway that was actually created to go all the way up to Alaska, I think, for the wartime. I think that's what the original plan was, that road. And I think it actually goes up all the way. There's some sort of pathway.
Nordegg and whatnot.
Yeah, all the way up. I've been on that road up towards Nordegg and so on, but just years and years and years ago, Marianne, my wife and I, we went up that way and we found the trail. We said, oh, we'll do this trail. It's a fire tower lookout, whatever. And we just hiked and biked and pushed our bike all the way up. It was the worst possible thing. But you know, when you got up to the top, it was okay. It was like, oh my God, this is such a beautiful view. It was like, that's fine. We just killed ourselves for nothing.
So you're saying the work was not equal to the reward?
No. Much better places out in like Kananaskis, like Jumping Pound Ridge, Cox Hill. Those are great rides and they've been around for such a long time, but they're epic. I mean, when you look at those, when you get to the top of those ridges and you look and just, you see Kananaskis and the whole area, it's so beautiful.
If someone was to come out riding here, where is the one spot you would say? Just Kananaskis, I guess, eh?
Yeah, Kananaskis. I mean, I think if they were coming out this way, you know, towards Calgary, Canmore, whatever, I'd definitely say Kananaskis, Jumping Pound Ridge, Cox Hill, those would be, but there's so many new trails that they have, not new, but they've kind of diverged, changed them. The names have changed and so on and so forth. So I haven't been to some of them, but there's one there that's called Razor's Edge, which is not far actually from between, you know, the 40 and Canmore, Lac des Arcs and so on. And it's a bit kind of, it's a little bit more of a crazy ride. So it wouldn't be just for anybody.
It's an advanced ride. Yeah.
Yeah. Something my daughter likes to do.
Yeah. She's crazy. She's a lunatic.
Yeah, she is. And living in Kamloops, she gets to do more of that kind of crazy stuff. So
yeah. I hope to get her on a bike.
Oh man. She'd be like, oh, she'd be great. Going crazy. If she got on a motocross. I'm kind of worried about that though, because I think she gets on a motocross, she might be hooked.
Yeah. Well, she had the chance. Yeah. And then,
well, she tried it in Moab. Yeah, that's right. I told you there's a guy, Sean and Maria, that live here in Canmore, and they were out in Moab and they were like, hey, you want to drive Maria's bike? And then Santa was like, sure. And so she went out on it. She was like, this is just so much fun. And I'm like, oh my God, what do we just do?
Yeah.
Created a monster.
Yeah, man. I tried to stoke that fire. We just haven't connected. Pandemic really screwed it in the end there. But like now Paula's getting a whatever the 250.
So she did decide on, well, she's looking at it.
By the time this, anybody else hears this, yeah, she's decided. Like, she's just like,
what was she riding before?
125L.
125. Like, so this is a
step up.
A step up. Like, more power? Is that what it is? Is that the difference between when you go 125, 250? This is an inexperienced, obviously, guy.
So she's basically riding on a bike that's too small for her physically and underpowered for her.
Okay.
And her ability.
Okay.
So if she was to spend another year on that bike, she'd plateau or descend in talent kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So just like, I got her sitting on bikes so I could try to find a secondhand one for her. And then, the pandemic has dried up the secondhand market and driven up prices. So people are asking way too much money for these bikes. And,
so you're better off buying a new one.
At you think $3,800 for one that's 13 years old.
Wow.
And then, or $6,000 for a brand new one. If I got the old one, I'm going to put money into it just to get it like going. So like in the end we'll save like what, $1,000 or something and never really have peace of mind and maybe, and no longevity.
Yeah.
So this bike she's going to buy, she could ride until she gives it up, you know, and then
and they give you a warranty of some sort. I'm sure
6 months.
6 months. There you go.
Only on that one. The 250R has no warranty, so like, you know, the she's got an F, so it's got a warranty.
Okay.
And then, but it's not an, it's a family bike, man. Like,
so when we look at these bikes, between something that's $6,000 and $8,000, big difference in motocross or no?
Yeah. Suspension. Yeah,
okay. So suspension basically wise. Okay. So yeah,
the motor might stay the same or similar, right? Yeah. They're just going to change some internals, but like the frame and the suspension starts to change. And the more you spend, the better these things become.
Yeah. Just like mountain biking. Just like mountain biking. Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. Totally. You can go for and the funny part about it is I think, like the Fox fork that I have on my mountain bike that I built up last year. I think the value on that Fox 34 is something like $1,600 just for that front fork. Right.
Yeah.
But then you can go off and buy a fork that's $500.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and the difference between them, yeah, there's probably a fairly big difference for the person that knows.
Yeah.
But for the person that doesn't know. So for me to get on a motocross, let's say, and I don't ride motocross, I wouldn't know this difference because I don't know. It's the same thing on a snowboard. You know, we talk about snowboards, for example, right? And about my son, a brand new snowboard for Christmas because he wasn't playing hockey. He's got a snowboard, whatever. And the board he had before was a older one and it was heavier and whatever. So I thought, I got him a new board, right? So I got him a new board and, you know, got on it. And I said, so what? He's like, oh man, it's so light. It's so whatever. But because he knows snowboard now, he's ridden enough. He recognized the difference in the flexibility of it. And yeah, I could do the 360s off that. I'm doing this. And I'm like, wow, you know, so that's the difference between, you know, knowing what you're riding and not knowing. Right. Yep. So again, you know, so I think that's the big part. So it's now Paula knows what she's riding.
Yeah. The step up for her, it's just going to be clearance, like ground clearance, power, like low end torque.
Okay.
But I feel the suspension is very similar.
Similar. Okay.
Because they're not like, they're just traditional forks, but you just look at them and you can just see that they're not like a performance part.
Okay.
You know? And then, so yeah, whatever. The frame, it's a tube frame. Steel tube frame, mm-hmm. much like she has right now. So the rigidity, all that kind of stuff, but I don't imagine she's ever going to feel it. Like
do motocross frames break easily?
I don't think so.
No.
Well, I mean, everything breaks,
but
not at the level that like, not, I don't ride it. Well, I hit the earth hard enough that I could break something and it's resilient.
Well, that's the same thing with the mountain bikes. I mean, I know some guys that are, you know, super amazing riders, never broken a frame. And then there's guys that are super amazing riders, but are super hard on their bikes and they bust them. Mm-hmm. And it's just because they're doing stuff that
it's different. They take more chances,
Yeah. Go off bigger stuff and land it and crack.
Yeah. I take a chance and I just kick the thing over. So, and then, so you've got two kids.
Yep.
And,
One's in university and Kamloops and the other one's here.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're both athletic.
Yeah. I mean, two different kids though, different kids. My daughter, the ex enduro mountain bike rider, kind of crazy, loves all that hippie chick, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then I have the son that's the, you know, ex AAA hockey player kind of, but can play every bloody sport that exists out there. Just, you know, if you told him to play it, he'd be like right up there, you know? So he, he's a different kid though. He's definitely not, what I call a mountain kid. You know, it's like my daughter was a mountain kid. She was the, you know, let's go for a hike and I can do all that. He's like, nah, I'm not interested. And you know, the times we've taken him on like mountain bike and he can ride a mountain bike, but you know, times we take him on a mountain bike, he'd be at the top of the hill before all of us kind of going, you guys are so slow.
It's awesome.
And you'd be like, okay, dude. But then you try to keep up with a sister, which would not be a good thing. Yeah, fair. Because she had the technical ability and he didn't, right? So, and then he thought that sport was stupid because he didn't have that ability.
Trumped by the girl.
But you know, he's been on a little motocross before. He's tried that and I think he'd be pretty keen on a motocross.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, yeah.
That speaks to everybody, man. Like the smell of the gasoline, the sound of the engine. Like.
Well, you know, I think the other part about motocross is I think it's I think it takes a lot of core strength to
pilot it,
to manage it, you know, more so than a mountain bike does, to be honest. And I think when I look at, you know, guys that ride motocrosses, race them. I mean, they take off their tops and do whatever. They six packs and whatever else. Oh, yeah. You look at them, they're going, holy.
I'm not that guy.
No beer belly.
Yeah. I'm the dad bod version.
Dad bod version.
All my core muscles are hidden underneath.
That's the majority of people. Insulation. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Well, it's like one of the things that Paul and I noticed when we first started going to the events and like the races, like the cross country races, mm-hmm. is just some of the most unfit looking guys are fast as shit. Right. Like, and they can just fly. It's an endurance game. Core helps you, stay on the machine and endure some of what's coming. But technique will get you over it.
That's the thing. These guys have probably been riding for years, right? Yeah. They're your age, but the thing is they've been riding since they were probably 8 years old. Yeah. Right. And so for them to getting on a motocross is like closing their eyes and riding it, right? Not a problem. And they have the technique. And that's a big part about it is I've seen those bigger guys that are just, they just have technique and it's not about like, they just know how to maneuver the bike. And you're like, wow, how'd you do that? You don't look like you can do that, but you can.
Oh man. So, like I remember a time, back when I was trying to understand or learn kite surfing.
Oh,
in Alberta, there's not a lot of spots that it's suitable in the summer, uh-huh. right? Like winter, you can ski kite a lot of spots that you couldn't mm-hmm. In the summer. And so we went down to Kehoe and, there was this fella trying to get into his wetsuit. He was a big guy and he asked for some help. So I literally stuffed him in like you might like get a woman into a corset kind of thing, like pushing him, folding his flesh underneath the zipper.
Yeah.
Like packing him into this fucking thing.
Yeah.
And he was a big guy.
Yeah.
And then, so he's telling us about how he was like a windsurfing champion. He was the first person in Alberta to do a 360 roll on a windsurf, like a, whatever
regular
surfboard.
Windsurf, yeah.
And just like bragging.
Yeah.
And like behind him are my two friends and they're just like the face they're giving me is this guy's so full of shit. Like he can't even fit into his fucking wetsuit. Like how the fuck is this guy? He can't get off the ground. How's he going to fly upside down? Right. And so then he gives us a little pep talk. And like, cause he'd watched us fuck around with this little 3 meter kite and get dragged through shit on a cow patty. and then he gets up. Gets to the edge, asks for some help because he can't carry all his gear. He's like out of breath and just like out of shape and whatever. And so it was fucking windy, like so windy we weren't even going to bother trying. Like cause it's the windiest lake in the province.
Okay.
He sets up, fucking launches, and just like graceful as fuck.
You think he'd been doing it all his life?
He had been, yeah. He did like these whips, so you sort of like power dive, so you raised a kite up in the air, cut it through the sky, and then just launched the surfboard up into the air. And he's just doing these things. Mm. Gave us like this master class on how to fucking ride, and then come back in.
That's crazy.
And the faces on my friends changed from scorn to respect. Like this guy is the shit.
Yeah.
He just whatever, man.
Just hasn't taken a sponsorship with the Coors Light or something.
Yeah, maybe. too many free wings at fucking Moxie's.
Johnny Walker and had the Earl's sponsorship package.
Yeah, man.
Saying the kite, Evan's got one of those. He's got one of the
snow kite.
He's got the one of those little practice kites. My brother-in-law, Ozzy, Tony, he gave him the kite because he was he'd been learning how to do it. Actually, learned out in Australia when we went in 2016.
Nice,
and they were doing it on the beach, and then I did it a couple of times, and then Tony just said, "Hey, take this practice kite and whatever." And so the other day when it was windy, he went out to Elizabeth Rummel and the thing.
Holy
and
shit.
He was flying it, just flying it. But it wasn't like, he says, "We got to do this on skates, Dad. This is crazy."
On his snowboard.
Oh, well, yeah. I thought about that and I thought,
take him out to spray.
Yeah.
And then the snowboarder skis, whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if he can ski.
No. Well, he can't ski, but he snowboards. So it would probably be better for him to snowboard, but he can handle the kite. That's the thing about it is he knows how to fly the kite and how to control it, which is, I think that's such a big one, right? Cause that's the reason you have these practice kites is to learn how to control that first, right?
Just learn how to whip it in the sky to get the drag.
Yeah.
And then set it. Like once you catch up to the wind, there's kind of like you can just park it and then it'll just pull you.
Yep.
But then you got to figure out how to steer it back upwind.
Yeah.
Right. Like going downwind. Downwinders are a lot of fun. Uh-huh. So it's like if you, at spray, if you
sort of let him set up at one end and then you go down some.
Well, we thought we thought originally, like, he was like, we got to do this when, you know, at the beginning of the season, when the ice is just perfect. And we take, I would go get on my skates. I said, no, you're going to be flying up in the air, dude.
Yeah, no idea. And then that's the thing too, coming down. If he comes down hard, like, I would wear a life vest. No, because, like, the whole lake's frozen, but there's thin spots and whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And you can come, like, you can land. You can get lofted up and then have no more air. So you come down, like, as if you were that high in the air, right?
Wow.
You know, and it's not going to slow you, like, because it's a practice kite, so it's not like.
No, exactly. I don't know. I just, you know, I look at that and I think, I always wanted to do it, like, on the water.
Yeah.
And many, many years ago, we were in Club Med. This is, like, before kids and whatever. And I thought, I want to try to do this. And, but they were like, no, you had to sign up for 4 or 5 days. And, you know, I'd missed the boat and all that. But I was like, oh, I really want to do that. So I did the surfing instead and the wakeboarding. And the wakeboarding, that was a funny one, because wakeboarding was like, the guy, he was some guy there, he says, oh, have you ever water skied? And I said, no, but we snowboard. We're good snowboarders. He says, oh, you won't get this. I was like, okay. And both my wife and I, first thing, boom, we got up on the wakeboard and we had a good time.
Well, that brings us to the end of another episode. I want to thank my guests for taking the time to sit down and chat with me. A special thank you to you, my supporters. Without you, this would not be possible. If you enjoyed the show, give it a 5-star rating. And if you haven't already, be sure to like, subscribe, and share. If this is your first time listening, I encourage you to take the 3-episode challenge. Once again, thank you for your continued support, and stay tuned to find out what's coming up next time.